Good evening. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the 2016 Karl Popper Memorial Lecture. My name is Brian Roberts. I'm a philosopher of physics here in the Department of Philosophy, Logic, and Scientific Method at LSE. Those of you who have spent time at LSE knows what an incredible, exciting place this is to work. It's full of ideas, the energy of the students, the staff, and it's also a chance to be a part of history. And a big part of that history at LSE, as you may know, is Sir Karl Popper. You're going to hear more about Sir Karl in a moment. But when Karl Popper passed away in 1994, the department worked with the LSE to start the Karl Popper Memorial Fund. And thanks to the generous donations of many people, for more than 20 years, we've been supporting LSE students who are inspired by Popper's work. And we've been holding this lecture series, the Karl Popper Memorial Lecture Series, which I have the pleasure of welcoming you to now. This year's lecture will be introduced and chaired by Professor Jason McKenzie Alexander. Professor Alexander is a philosopher of science and evolutionary game theorist who's worked on the evolution of morality and social norms, as well as the foundations of decision theory. I'm very pleased to welcome him to the stage now. Let's give him a hand.
Thanks, Brian. It's been 70 years since Karl Popper first arrived at the London School of Economics, and we are here tonight to celebrate his legacy with this memorial lecture. Popper's influence on the philosophy of science and the public understanding of science has been extraordinary. I would say legendary if it were not for the fact that his views about scientific practice have become so deeply embedded into popular culture that many people know his views without knowing his name. How many people believe that although science cannot establish the truth of a theory, that a theory can be tested and eventually falsified? I know I was taught that as a young student many years ago. Given this understanding of science, it's a great pleasure to have with us tonight Sir Paul Nurse, a geneticist, former president of the United, the Royal Society, many apologies, it was watching the debate that just pushed me over the edge. Yeah. Former president of the Royal Society and chief executive and director of the Francis Crick Institute. In his research since 1976, Paul has had many opportunities to put scientific theories to the test. His dogged pursuit of the truth has led to numerous awards and honors, in particular the 2001 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for his discovery of cyclin-dependent kinase, a key regulator of the cell cycle. Now, far be it for me to pit one Nobel laureate against another, but I think it's worth noting that the relationship between philosophy and science has not always been a friendly one. Richard Feynman once said that philosophy of science is about as useful to scientists as ornithology is to birds. Tonight, I believe Paul will describe a rather more sympathetic understanding of the relationship between philosophy and science. For those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for tonight's event is LSEPopper. I would ask you to please put your phones on silent so as to not disrupt the event. Tonight's talk is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast later. Paul will speak for approximately 1 hour, leaving a half hour for questions afterwards. Now, will you please join me in welcoming Sir Paul Nurse to LSE to deliver his lecture entitled How Philosophy Drives Discovery, A Scientist's View of Popper.
Well, good evening, everybody. Pleasure to be here and to see all of you here. I have to say I feel rather daunted, frankly, certainly underqualified to give a talk on Karl Popper, especially here, his old academic home. I'm a scientist, as you heard. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not even a pub philosopher. But, though I do know the George next door, by the way. But I do have an interest in philosophy, and it is true to say that I have been influenced by the work of philosophers of science, and that includes particularly Karl Popper. So I hope maybe that my personal experiences as a scientist may be of interest to this audience and how it has helped me drive discovery in my own research. Now, my first exposure, really, to philosophy of science was when I was a graduate student. I was a biological sciences graduate student, PhD, University of East Anglia in the 1970s. I was only in my second year as a research student, but I was, quite frankly, in an intellectual crisis. And that crisis was making me contemplate abandoning my already rather short career as an experimental scientist. I was working on cells. Yeah, I still work on cells. At the basic unit of life, of course, but things were not really going particularly well. Now, the problem was not carrying out my experiments. On the whole, they were sort of working all right. It was deciding what experiments I should do and how I could build on the results of those experiments. What I was doing, and it was fairly tedious, as much research is, I'm afraid, in the sciences, perhaps also in the London School of Economics too, but I was measuring the levels of different chemicals in cells in a rather random sort of fashion. And it was not really clear to me as to why this was important or how it was telling me anything interesting about how cells work. I could not see how to proceed from the data I was gathering to ideas of more general interest about the workings of cells. And I was beginning to think perhaps I should change my studies and change my studies actually to the philosophy and history of science. And even rather naively wondered whether I might be able to come to as a student to LSE. Really completely true. And to prepare for such a possibility, I was beginning to read some of Popper's books, because of course I knew he was here. And having been introduced to his thinking through the more popular writings of Peter Medawar, who was an experimental biologist, or a Nobel laureate, and was a great fan of Popper. But what happened was interesting, because instead of providing an escape route for me from experimental science to do something more philosophical or historical, the reading of his books really helped me out of my intellectual crisis. So it was a great help to me. It showed me a way to think about experiments and how to use them to develop more general scientific ideas. It literally helped me to rescue my career as a research scientist. So I owe, and I think he was a rather miserable person, but I owe him a great debt. So exactly what was the basis of that intellectual crisis that that Popper helped me with? The problem was that I was trying to advance my research by first gathering together as much data as I could, and then to look for generalities, for patterns, from which I could generate a higher level theory to explain what was happening. I had another difficulty, a more theoretical one, related to the issue of induction. That is to how to infer from specific particulars to generalities. And I was aware that this is, of course, a serious philosophical problem. I was aware David Hume had discussed this at length, and the difficulties that were encountered logically when moving from particulars to generalities. And that obviously troubled me, because in interpreting my experiments, that's exactly what I was trying to do, to make general inferences made upon particular results. More practically, I could not work out, as I've already said, what experiments to do, and I was gradually sinking under a mass of data and making no progress. I was getting depressed. Now, all graduate students get depressed, of course, but I was getting seriously depressed. What I needed was a guide, a compass, to provide direction in my experiments. And what Popper introduced to me was, frankly, the possibility of taking perhaps a simpler approach. Rather than focusing on accumulating all the relevant experimental data up front necessary to allow a grand synthesis, he proposed an alternative, perhaps more bolder way. I quote from him in Conjectures and Refutations. So this is Popper. Without waiting passively for repetitions to impress or impose regularities upon us, we actively try to impose regularities upon the world. We try to discover similarities in it and to interpret it in terms of laws invented by us. Without waiting for premises, we jump to conclusions. These may have to be discarded later, should observation show that they are wrong. This was a theory of trial and error, of conjectures and refutations. The method of trial and error is a method of eliminating false theories by observation statements, by jumping first to any theory and then testing it to find whether it is good or not, i.e. by repeatedly applying the critical method, eliminating bad theories and inventing new ones. So that was Popper's, one of several quotes I will have from Popper. What I thought Popper was recommending there was to think about moving from systematically collecting observational experiments to rather rapidly producing provisional interpretation and hypothesis, to try and generate a conceptual framework for understanding the experimental observations, and to do that through intuitive leaps of the imagination. The leaps may be wrong, but that is not a problem because they can then be discarded through this process of trial and error. And what Popper emphasized for me was that this process of trial and error that a scientist should use is more sophisticated than I had thought, because it places emphasis on the errors to advance knowledge. And that was a little sort of counterintuitive for me. He did this rather nicely, perhaps dramatically, certainly theatrically, by comparing Einstein with an amoeba. I quote Popper again. The method of trial and error is applied not only by Einstein, but in a more dogmatic fashion by the amoeba also. You know, that's a very simple protozoan, single-celled animal. The difference lies not so much in the trials as in a critical and constructive attitude towards errors. Errors which the scientist consciously and cautiously tries to uncover in order to refute his theories with searching arguments, including appeals to the most severe experimental tests, which his theories and his ingenuity permit him to design. The critical attitude may be described as the conscious attempt to make our theories, our conjectures, suffer in our stead in the struggle for the survival of the fittest. A number of sort of metaphors in there, the amoeba, survival of the fittest. Not quite sure they all make sense, but I think you get the idea. However, Popper also seemed to be saying that for this approach to work effectively, the theories developed should have a particular quality. They need to encourage further testing. Again, I quote from Popper. We require that the new theory should be independently testable. That is to say, apart from explaining all the explicanda, this is the only Popper is the only person I've ever known who uses this word, explicanda. I can barely pronounce it, actually. Which the new theory was designed to explain, it must have new and testable consequences, preferably consequences of a new kind. It must lead to the prediction of phenomena which have not so far been observed. This requirement seems to me indispensable, since without it, our new theory might be ad hoc, for it is always possible to produce a theory to fit any given set of explicanda. Now, from these readings, which I have to say were a bit tough for me as a budding graduate student, I was beginning to see, however, a way out of my intellectual dilemmas. Popper had supplied a compass that helped to guide me through the experiments. Instead of systematically accumulating a mass of experimental observations and searching for generalities, he, of course, was arguing a different way. After making some observations relevant to the phenomenon of interest, I should move quickly to a conjecture, a theory, that could provide this conceptual framework that would help me to understand my data. And in my case, thinking about my own research, a theory, I could develop a theory to help me guide the experiments, and that would, for example, to look at the levels of chemicals I was measuring and to see whether they played an important role in what I ended up studying, which was whether a cell should decide to divide or not. So it was getting that conceptual framework that was which helped me, and it really did help me. And I began to see a way through being submerged under the data. Now, I learned more. Getting to a theory requires imagination and intuition, the creative aspects of scientific investigation. A powerful theory is one that is bold and makes new predictions that can be tested with new experiments. Experiments designed to knock the theory down rather than confirm it. And of course, I was taught in a way to do the complete opposite. I think you were referring to the same issue. For me, this was a real insight. It elevated the importance of skepticism, an attitude of mind which strives to falsify rather than to verify. If the new experiments do not support the theory, then it should be rejected and a new one devised. After that, the cycle of conjecture and refutation should be repeated. The new theories developed will lead to new predictions and to new tests. Even if the theory survives the first tests, I should come up with yet new experiments to test it again. The more demanding, the better. This is counterintuitive. You know, once you have a good idea, you learn to love it. And I learned I should hate it. I should attack it. I should be the idea's worst enemy. Over time, a theory that survives repeated testing will become more and more fit at providing an explanation for the phenomenon. Essentially, this is really a Darwinian approach to knowledge. It's a trial and error process. The trials are the experiments that are carried out to test the theories. The errors emerge when the experiments do not support the predictions that the theories make. It is the recognition of these errors that allows corrections to be made. And that is an important way for science to advance. What this also made me realize was that implicit in this approach is that scientific knowledge evolves. At some stages of a scientific investigation, knowledge is very tentative, and it is only after repeated testing that it becomes more secure. Newton's laws of motion would be an example of secure knowledge. Well, at least in our everyday experience, that is outside the domains of the very small, the very large, and the very fast, where Newton isn't quite so good, of course. Newton's laws are successful due to repeated rounds of successful testing. Whilst, in contrary, predictions made, for example, at the early stages of, say, an infectious disease epidemic are likely to be very tentative. They're not in the same place. When you hear on Radio 4 some scientists predicting whether Ebola virus is going to wipe out humanity or not, you know very well it is highly likely to be wrong, whatever they say. They do their best, but it's very, very difficult. It is not the same as Newton's law of motion. Popper also helped me to deal a bit better with the problem of induction. Now, he referred to Hume, who I mentioned briefly, and said the following. Hume was right in stressing that our theories cannot be validly inferred from what we can know to be true, neither from observations nor from anything else. He concluded from this that our belief in them was therefore irrational. Now, if belief means here our inability to doubt our natural laws and the consistency of natural regularities, then Hume is again right. This kind of dogmatic belief has, one might say, a physiological rather than a rational basis. If, however, the term is taken to cover our critical acceptance of scientific theories, a tentative acceptance combined with an eagerness to revise the theory if we succeed in designing a test which it cannot pass, then Hume was wrong. In such an acceptance of theories, there is nothing irrational. There is not even anything irrational in relying, for practical purposes, upon well-tested theories, for no more rational course of action is open to us. It doesn't solve the problem of induction, but it allowed me to look about it and think about it in a different way. Now, Popper's view about the growth of scientific knowledge also helped me to understand what science is. He wanted to distinguish between science and pseudoscience, to demarcate science from other intellectual activities. He did this when he argued that the key distinguishing feature of science is that a scientific theory should be testable and therefore be, in principle, refutable. Another very interesting concept. He said, and I quote again, "A theory which is not refutable by any conceivable event is non-scientific. Irrefutability is not a virtue of a theory, as people often think. It is a vice. Every genuine test of a theory is an attempt to falsify it or to refute it. Confirming evidence should not count, except when it is the result of a genuine test of the theory. And this means that it can be presented as a serious but unsuccessful attempt to falsify the theory. One can sum all of this up by saying that the criterion of the scientific status of a theory is its falsifiability or refutability or testability." And he illustrated his argument, once again using Einstein, but this time comparing him with astrologers. "Einstein's theory of gravitation clearly satisfies the criterion of falsifiability. Even if our measuring instruments at the time did not allow us to pronounce on the results of the tests with complete assurance, there was clearly a possibility of refuting the theory. Astrology does not pass that test. Astrologers are greatly impressed and misled by what they believe to be confirming evidence, so much so that they were quite unimpressed by any unfavourable evidence. Moreover, by making their interpretations and prophecies sufficiently vague, they were able to explain away anything that might have been a refutation of the theory had the theory and the prophecies been more precise. In order to escape falsification, they destroyed the testability of their theory." Of course, Newton was a bit interested in astrology too, we should say. Now, another aspect of doing science that I understood better after reading Popper was that the movement from initial observations or experiments to conjectures that can form the foundation for an eventual hypothesis had another implication beyond the ability to generate a conceptual framework for effective consideration of those observations and experiments. That implication was that our understanding of nature is significantly conditioned by the human mind. And in coming to this conclusion, Popper refers to Immanuel Kant. He writes this in Quantum Theory and Schism in Physics. "We owe to Kant the first great attempt to combine a realistic interpretation of natural science with the insight that our scientific theories are not simply the result of a description of nature, of reading the book of nature without prejudice, but that they are rather the products of the human mind. Our intellect does not draw its laws from nature, it imposes its laws upon nature. I have attempted," this is Popper, "to improve this excellent and Kantian formulation as follows. Our intellect does not draw its laws from nature, but it tries with varying success to impose upon nature laws which it freely invents. This was pretty sobering thought for me. It argues that the workings of the human mind have a great influence on our interpretation of nature. This, I realise, is obvious to philosophers, but was less obvious for me as an experimental scientist trained to respect the primacy of observation and experimental data to generate a better understanding of the natural world." So that's something of interest to think about. So Popper helped me get through my PhD and my later research by showing me how to look at research and the scientific endeavour more generally in new ways, including how to develop a greater order in my experimental investigations. He made me realise the importance of boldness and of creativity in science, the spark that allows leaps from initial data to bigger pictures that can be made more reliable over time by repeated testing. These ways of thinking have constantly helped me. However, and now I'm going to change my tone somewhat, I've also experienced situations in my research which diverge from such pure Popperian approaches, at least so it seems to me. And I thought if I relate these, they may also be of some interest to this audience. However, to explain them properly, I will have to give you some details of some of the experiments, and I do hope that's all right. One example runs, frankly, counter to what I've already praised and explained, helped me during my PhD. It concerns the usefulness of systematic observation and experiment without a specific hypothesis in mind. I remind you, remember, I was sinking under the accumulation of data. I've already explained there's a real danger in such an approach of aimless wandering through descriptions of the natural world without a clear direction of travel. But we have to admit that such approaches have been useful in science. Tycho Brahe recorded vast volumes of astronomical data informing Kepler's views about the movement of celestial bodies without any real clear idea about what he was trying to achieve in understanding the world. He just was convinced it would be useful. Similarly, Charles Darwin, in his autobiography, said, "I proceeded on true Baconian principles and without any theory collected facts on a wholesale scale." Now, Darwin here is referring to Francis Bacon, not the painter, of course, but the philosopher at the dawn of modern science, who argued that the collection of observed particulars, today we would say facts about the natural world, in an unbiased manner was a critical step in science. I think probably a reaction against the excessive trust in books as against observation that often dominated scholarly activities at the time, or just before that time. However, although Darwin stated here in this quote I've just given you that he was Baconian in his approach, elsewhere his writing is rather less clear about this point. For example, in a letter to Alfred Wallace, the other person or main person who argued for the role of natural selection in evolutionary change, he, in 1857, he said, "I am a firm believer that without speculation, there is no good and original observation," which is rather counter to what he just said. So I think dear old Charles is a bit confused over this matter. Now, turning to my own experiences in this situation, I found that in certain situations, important advances could be made by making out observations and carrying out experiments without a clear hypothesis in mind. As long, and this is critical, as the area under study is of great interest, so you're not wandering aimlessly in a place where of no interest. So it has to be interesting what you're doing, and that requires understanding and intuition. And there needs to be a discipline to keep such undirected wandering under control. So it has to be interesting, and you have to have a discipline. The importance of the area being of great interest is of key. If the area is relatively new and lacking in relevant observations, generating hypotheses too early runs the danger of speculation being divorced from reality and too conditioned by the human mind. In other words, I'm making a rather different argument here from what Popper himself said. Now, why did I say this? My research interest was the reproduction of cells. Cell, basic unit of life, reproduction, one of the basic properties of life, that is seen in its simplest form with the division of cells from 2 to 4 to 8 and so on. The reproduction of cells and its control is therefore a critical problem in biology, which I studied most of my life. And it underpins the growth and reproduction of all living organisms. It's also of great relevance to cancer. Now, when I began research on this issue, now many years ago in the 70s, very little was known about the control of this process. And I needed to make some observations and some experiments simply to be able to develop any hypotheses at all. And this is sort of somewhat counter to what I've said. We had to get some data there just to help kick our ideas off. It was a precondition for sensible speculation and conjectures. And I give an example. I decided to collect mutants randomly that would define the genes that were required for cell reproduction. I used yeast as a convenient and simple model system for these experiments. And many of these were carried out just across the road, the other side of Portugal Street, where the Imperial Cancer Research Fund and Cancer Research UK had its laboratories, and I've worked there on and off for about 25 years of my life, looking in at this building on the other side of the street, in actual fact. Now, the mutants I first collected were ones that were defective in genes that were required for cell reproduction, a process called the cell cycle. These weren't able to divide because cell division could not take place, because they were defective in a gene function that was necessary for that cell division process. However, cells could continue to grow, and so when observed under the microscope, they became much enlarged. So cells grow, then they divide, then they grow, then they divide. If they can't undergo the reproductive process, they grow and grow and grow, and you can easily see that under the microscope. And I use this to identify cell cycle genes, genes required for that reproductive process. And in my initial studies, I identified about 30 such genes. We now know that's less than 10% of the total. For me, it was a big advance, but more systematic studies that we've carried out shows it's very small. But they were useful for providing the material for future experimental study. But the immersion of the mind in these experiments, the sustained exposure to this reality, helped to generate hypotheses. And that's the sort of point I want to make. The problem had to be interesting, does require intuition and knowledge of the related work, and the ultimate goal of hypothesis generation must always be kept in mind. That's what I meant by discipline. But it gives you a certain direction in your thinking. Now, related to this is a further point, a rather whimsical comment, and that is that sometimes it's important to just follow where nature may lead you. That's why it sounds a little whimsical. As I explained above, I was searching for mutants which generate enlarged cells by visual inspection under microscope. Whilst pursuing the search for such mutants, I noticed, by complete accident, a colony of mutant cells made up of the complete opposite type, a colony made up of small cells, the opposite characteristic to what I was searching for. Now, I'd never thought about small cells. Never occurred to me that that might be revealing. But seeing them under the microscope, and I can still see it now in my mind's eye, I just looked at them for several minutes, and then I realized that this mutant was reproducing faster than it could grow, and because it divided before it grew to the right amount, it was smaller. I mean, this is dead simple. This is not rocket science or rocket philosophy. But these mutants that were reproducing faster meant that they were altered in a gene which determined the rate at which cells could reproduce. And these mutants that produced enlarged cells, which is where I'd started, defined genes that were necessary for the cell cycle, whilst those that produced small cells defined genes that controlled the cell cycle, controlled the rate at which cells would go through that program. And these were, in fact, the very controlling genes that I was most interested in. This is what I was doing my study to try and find out. But the critical point is that I was led to them by accident. I didn't go through the hypothesis and test it. The hypothesis came to me by making the observations and seeing something that I hadn't thought of. This is something that Popper simply doesn't conceive of in his thinking. I simply had not worked out a way of how to find the most interesting mutants. So a powerful stimulant to the imagination, therefore, I concluded, can be to pay attention to nature itself, which can lead you in novel and productive directions, because it's already there in nature. It generates conjectures that are not based so entirely on mental activity, but are the result of the interactions between that mental activity and observation. Not hypothesis-driven exactly, but an important way to generate meaningful hypothesis. It may be related to what Louis Pasteur captured with his famous quote, "Where observation is concerned, chance favours the prepared mind," this interaction between thinking and observation. Now, taking these examples together, they illustrate that collecting data through experimental observation in a manner that is not driven by hypothesis can be a useful mechanism for generating hypotheses that can then be tested. So it's a little more complicated than perhaps Popper was originally arguing for. This unbiased approach to data collection is not so different from what Francis Bacon was arguing for and can be useful if, in my opinion, it's considered as a preliminary for generating the conjectures discussed by Karl Popper. It allows the natural world to have greater impact on our thought processes that can result in imaginative leaps to generate explanatory hypotheses. I have a feeling this may be more relevant to the biological sciences than the physical sciences, but that may be something we can discuss. Another example of perhaps a variation from the approach of Popper that I experienced was when I was testing a hypothesis that there was a critical controlling point close to the beginning of the cell cycle, when cells start their reproductive program, when cells become irreversibly committed to that program, in the sense that once they've undergone passage through a certain step, they can't do any alternative pathways. They just have to go on and finish the reproductive process. I was testing that hypothesis, and I'd done a number of experiments that were completely compatible with that idea. And just before I intended to write this up as a paper, has to be said at the time I was just coming to the end of a contract, I needed that paper to get a job and all that sort of stuff. And so I was just on the edge of putting this together when I did an experiment and I got the wrong result. What do I mean by the wrong result? I mean it wasn't the result I was looking for. I discovered that a mutant that was needed for a late stage in the cell cycle gave a mixed result. Some cells were committed to the cell cycle and some were not. Totally incompatible with the theory I was testing, which is that commitment occurs at the beginning. Once you're past that point, you're totally committed. Here I had cells at the end and some were committed and some were not. Now this result, in strictly Popperian terms, meant I should reject the hypothesis. It was the one that pulled the rug from under my feet. But I was reluctant to do that, whether it's because I wanted to publish the paper and get a job, I'm not quite so sure, but I was reluctant to do that because all the other data I had fitted the hypothesis. For Popper living in his ethereal world, I don't think that mattered to him, but it sort of did matter to me, maybe because I laboured with my hands and produced all of that data. Really not sure about that. I was convinced that I must be making a mistake with that experiment, and I wasted several months repeating it in a myriad of different ways, trying to get the right result. I never got the right result. And this is a problem with a pure Popper way of thinking because it does not take full account of the messiness of real data and real experiment. We do messy experiments and we wrestle with this all the time, especially in biology. So when we get something we don't like, we generally assume we're making some technical mistake. And we're getting the wrong result. And if we just do it right, we will get the right result. There's something in all of this reproducibility and the lack of it in the biological and biomedical sciences. Now, eventually, after repeatedly getting the same result, I progressed. I felt that maybe I should believe I was getting the right result. Now, this actually took me quite a few months, I have to say, to even take my own data in this experiment seriously. And I began to think, how could the original hypothesis be modified to take account of this aberrant result? But I could not come up with a modified hypothesis, which again should have led me to abandon it. But in fact, and this gradually emerged for me, the explanation lay elsewhere. And that was with the experimental assumptions that I'd made in setting up the experiment. And that is a little different from falsifying the hypothesis. I had assumed that mutants in a particular gene could only arrest at one point in the cell cycle, one point in that program. And a single gene is expected to carry out a single function and to act at a single step in the cell cycle. But in fact, the gene that I was investigating, the mutant in this gene, acted twice in the cell cycle. Once at the very end of the program, which was very easy to see, but a second time at the beginning of the program, which actually, because of the experimental way I was doing it, was actually difficult to spot. So the interpretation of the experimental results had to be modified to deal with this, but this didn't mean that the core hypothesis required modification. The error was in the way I'd set up the experiment. Incidentally, this experiment showing that a single gene was involved in the two major control points of the cell cycle, which was largely rejected by the majority of the field at the time, was a really major advance in this particular research. And it helped me greatly because nobody believed anything I was doing, which gave me a lot of time to actually investigate it. Often people, you know, there's a real advantage, this is a side story, there's a real advantage in not being believed, you know, because it means nobody follows you, and that means you can do more and more in actually in getting it right, so that, you know, you can take on the big American labs as a consequence of that. So, this experience taught me that there always needs to be an emphasis, in addition, on the critical evaluation of the data being used to test hypotheses. Maybe obvious, but sort of not made given prominence in a sort of proper way of thinking. Mistakes here can lead to rejection of the hypothesis when the real problem lies not with the hypothesis itself, but with the data being used to test that hypothesis. Sometimes it's necessary to challenge the data being used for a test as well as the hypothesis being tested, and this requires experience, intuition, good technical expertise, knowledge of the experimental system being investigated. The craftsmanship of doing science, you could say. All aspects of the problem being investigated have to be considered, including the validity and assumptions underpinning the way that the data is collected. Now, I want to move to the final part of my talk. I want to make one more comment about learned from my experience. It's not actually quite so much a challenge to Popper, but an additional perspective. I've already mentioned the messiness of experiments, which I don't think Popper takes on. I also don't think he takes on the messiness of scientists themselves. And that's what I want to end with. The starting point of what I want to say here is that scientists work together as a society, a community engaged in intellectual endeavour. And that community influences what science is done, what scientific conclusions are accepted. Thomas Kuhn made this clear in his Structure of Scientific Revolutions, referring to paradigm choice. He says, "As in political revolutions, so in paradigm choice. There is no standard higher than the assent of the relevant community. This issue of paradigm choice can never be unequivocally settled by logic and experiment alone. The community matters. Society matters, and that means we have to think about the sociology of that community." And what is being emphasized here, of course, by Kuhn, is that the pursuit of the scientific endeavor and the generation of scientific knowledge is influenced by the way the scientific community works as a society. And expanding upon this, it is the community which largely determines what research is done, what is published, particularly in high-profile scholarly journals, and what is accepted as scientific understanding. Now, this is not unreasonable. I mean, it's not unreasonable because the scientific community has the expertise, it has the specialized knowledge to be able to deal with this. The community generally also knows who should be trusted amongst the scientific experts. A point made by the historian of science Stephen Shapin, who said, "Scientists know so much about the natural world by knowing so much about whom they can trust." That's a really critical point. You know, when I read a paper which is strange, and I see it's written, the results or conclusions are strange, and I immediately look to see who's written it. And if it's somebody who you can trust, who generally be right, you take it seriously. If it's somebody who's often been wrong, you do not. I mean, this is just human. Sometimes people say you must review a paper anonymously. You have no idea who, you know, as if that it helps you to be objective. This is a messy business. Would you buy a second-hand car without looking at the person who used to own it? It's in the same category. So what's being emphasized here by Kuhn is that the pursuit of the scientific endeavor, the generation of scientific knowledge, is influenced by the way the scientific community works as a society. And that's really very, very important. And relying on the consensual position of the majority of scientists is really sensible most of the time, and over the great issues that often attract public and political attention, such as climate change, the safety of GMOs, the validity of evolution, reliance on the expert scientific community, rather than commentators driven more by their politics, their ideologies, or their religious beliefs, is the much safer option. Perhaps we do need to rely on experts after all. However, having said all of that, the consensus opinion of the science community may not always be right, and that's the point I want to make. It can be over-influenced by fads, by powerful figures in the field, by what is published in the high-profile journals, by work that may be flawed or even fraudulent. In my experience, these sorts of issues, which do occur, tend to occur rather early on in studies of a particular research area, at a time when the observations and experiments and arguments are limited, and when intellectual discourse is at an earlier stage. And in these situations, sometimes an incorrect view of a scientific issue can become dominant, influenced by the sociology and behaviour of the scientific community. And that does occur. But my argument is that this is usually rather short term, because Popper can come to our rescue in this situation. Because embracing a culture of scepticism, of constant testing of favoured hypotheses, with the intention of bringing about their refutation, of viewing scientific knowledge as tentative, all provide a powerful corrective to incorrect science. Science, if we respect those aspects in that culture, is self-correcting. But it can take time for that correction to take place. And we need to be aware that sometimes we have to deal with the messiness of scientists themselves and how they behave, as well as the messiness of the experiments. And it requires some better understanding of the sociology and social structures of scientists. Having said all of this, Popper is a very useful guide, and continues to be so, for my research. Real scientific investigation is perhaps messier than Popper imagined, based as it is on people who are not always infallible and on data that can be unreliable. But keeping a Popperian approach always in mind helps provide a greater rigour and a more disciplined focus on trying to understand how the natural world works. There's no question that Popper has been a major driver of my own research. His guidance has been invaluable to me. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much for your lecture. We will now open the floor to questions from the audience. There will be roving microphones that will be circulated for people who have questions. If you could, please let us know your name and affiliation and wait for the stewards to get the microphone to you. That would be much appreciated. Can I see hands about who has a question?
I suffer a bit from tinnitus, so I don't always hear clearly. So if I don't answer the question you asked, just sort of ask it again, okay?
So could we begin, please, with the person in the back row in the middle, right there.
Hello. Thank you very much. My name is Daniela Duca. I'm from, I work at JISC. My question is about a reproducibility of science and where does it sit within the Popper framework?
Yeah. So I briefly sort of refer to that obliquely towards the end of my talk. I've worked for a long time in science, and in biology, it is sometimes quite difficult to do experiments because it relies on material that isn't always so consistent and on technical approaches which differ in subtle details that may be important or require strong technical skills. And all of these can legitimately contribute to a lack of reproducibility. You may have heard me say I work on yeast. And the main reason I worked on yeast is because the data you can get from such a simple organism is very reproducible. It can be grown in a very consistent way. Its genetics is very stable. I can test whether I know exactly what I'm dealing with. And I always felt unhappy with more complicated systems because you never could be quite sure of that reproducibility. What I'm arguing there is in the biological sciences, by the very nature of the material we work with, there can be difficulties with reproducibility, and I repeat, those are legitimate difficulties. In addition, however, there are difficulties that come about due to sloppy experimental investigation and even fraudulent behavior. I emphasize the first because there is a major contribution from there, but there are also fraudulent scientists and there are also sloppy scientists. And they can be encouraged to behave in less than perfect ways by pressures of the system or their perceived pressures of the system or pressures they put themselves under. And those can be different sorts of pressures. It can be pressure from a senior colleague. It can be pressures from their own motivation and ambition, or by the possibility of making money with a discovery. And they can be either totally fraudulent or simply self-deceiving, because nearly always when there is scientific fraud, it is exposed. It nearly always happens. Unless what you're publishing is so trivial that nobody's interested in it, when you might get away with it for some time, the very nature of it means that it will be exposed. So it is, if you're not simply self-deceiving, I mean, you will be found out. That's one of the corrections for it. Now, there is, and that's, I think, why you brought it up. I know it's a long answer. I hope it's interesting. But, I mean, you brought it up because quite a lot is made about this in some of the more popular media, which I think isn't quite balanced because it implies that much of the activity is fraudulent and it's driven by all these factors of making money and so on. What I'm telling you is, of course, is that error will be exposed. And once that happens, by the way, your career is finished. That's one thing that is, you know, you get a newspaper columnist and they can write whatever crap they like, and the next week they'll write more crap, and it doesn't matter. Whereas if I do something like that, my career is it's finished. You know, it's not unlike a lawyer telling lies in court. I mean, your career is finished. So the stakes are immensely high. And so people usually only, I've not actually come across it myself personally, though I've had to sit on groups who've had to look at other people's work. And it's usually involved with people who have got some behavioural issues that lead to it. Complicated business, don't always believe everything you read and their interpretation in the newspapers.
All right, thank you. Another question. So the individual there on the side, please.
Dr. Keith Postler, affiliated to LSE. Do you think that Popper would have a view, or would you imagine Popper to have a view on the perceived fracturing and narrowness of research in general now, whether scientific or in social science? Do you understand my question?
About narrowness?
Yes.
I'm not sure what Popper would think. I know what I would think. Is that of not quite of equal interest, but... I think I know what Popper thinks, but I know what I... So this is what I think. I think this is a major problem in our modern scholarly activities. I think that a too narrow a focus is problematic. I think we do need to have in-depth studies of particular topics, because without that in-depth understanding, you can't really get to the crux of issues. But when that is done to the point of excluding what I sometimes call peripheral knowledge of areas that are surrounding or adjacent to your major study, then it impoverishes what you do in a really quite significant way. And it's, of course, not helped by the huge amount of scholarly papers that are now produced in certain areas, which mean that my students and so on feel they have no alternative but just to focus on what their particular interests, because they get submerged in everything else. I have four graduate students and three postdoctoral workers, and I don't begin to try and match their understanding of their reading in their particular focused condition. They do that beautifully and better than I can. I only have one role in this reading, which is to expose them to things that they wouldn't read. So I simply take 3, 4, 5 high-quality journals, read some bits of it that are peripheral to what they work on. I rip the journals out, the papers out, then throw the rest of the journal away, and I give it to them to read. 90% of it, I'm sure they never do read, of course, but the idea is to broaden their interests. I also try to persuade them that they shouldn't work too hard, because if you work too hard and you're in the lab and you're just doing the same old thing day in, day out, you can't jump out of the rut of running along the rail of a particular way of thinking. And looking at other ways of thinking about issues helps you with that. So I think it's a major problem, but very understandable problem. And we really do need to teach in a different way and perhaps even encourage our students to really look across the breadth of the discipline rather than the single focus. And what's your view, by the way?
Well, my view is, what can one really do about it? I know you've given some suggestions, but I think it is a problem, and there needs to be a wider discussion of what to do about it because of the pressures of the research exercises that basically determine where the money goes and often where interest goes.
Well, the one comment I'd make to that is, of course, we as a community impose those pressures. We often try and blame somebody else, the journal, the research funding agency. This is all driven by us. So we can reform ourselves. I'm an idealist, of course.
All right, let's get some questions from the upper deck. So the person over there on this side by the door.
First of all, my name is Annie.
I've lost you. Where are you?
Oh, up there.
Oh, my word. There's an upstairs, so, too. Yeah.
Do you hear me? Do you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right. My name is Ali Paya. I'm a professor of philosophy here in London. I very much enjoyed your talk. But if you allow me, I would want to defend Popper about one of the points which you mentioned concerning his deviation from the deviation of his model from the actual practice of science. In particular, you mentioned Tycho Brahe and Darwin. And you mentioned that there is a way for scientists to begin with loads of data and then gradually develop some ideas. But remember, Popper also taught us that all observations, and I insist, all observations are theory-laden. And it means that there is no such a thing as simple and pure description. All descriptions are, if you like, interpretations in disguise.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but could you please get to the question part?
We do have low-level... No, it's a comment. So we do have low-level interpretations and high-level interpretations, high-level theories and low-level theories. But all of our observations and all of our data gathering are guided by our prior theories. Now, you mentioned Darwin, and you correctly quoted him with regard to his tendency
to... Thank you very much. Could you please...
Very quickly. To use inductive method. But remember, in 19th century, the scientific community were under the spell of John Stuart Mill and William Hewell. And they were pushing the agenda for inductivism.
I'm very sorry, but you've had your time on the floor. But thank you very much for your remarks.
I'll just comment on what I was saying about Darwin. I was saying only that he seemed to say two things that were rather different. One, I was only arguing that, and I suspect he was actually does both things. He made observation, which of course, if you read in The Voyage of the Beagle, is where he started, and he accumulated observation. But then he made sense of that observation by generating his ideas, which then, as a consequence, produced further observations that could test it. So I was only really saying, if you ask what I think, that there was an evolution in his thought that is not so different from what I was explaining at the end. Anyway.
All right. Yep. So we've got lots of time for questions, so I see a number of hands. So could we have the individual in the center in the front in the upper deck here, please? And then I'll come back down to the lower floor next.
Hi. Thank you, Sir Paul. My name is Janko Darmus. I'm an ex-student. My question concerns your view of the messiness of science. We used to have this ideal of the value-free science, and then possibly following Popper, we've come to accept that, okay, you have falsifiability and a bunch of stuff, but they're the good values. Could you comment on more messy sort of ethical and political values and if they do influence science in any way?
Well, science is carried out by people, and people are messy, and sometimes... when philosophers write about it, they don't fully appreciate that aspect of it. And we scientists don't either, actually. So we tend to think that, it's all like a chess game, and it isn't. So I do think that scientists are influenced by their society, their upbringing, where they find themselves, their politics. All of these things have to have an effect. What I also think, though, and where I came back to be more optimistic about it, is in the end, that through this repeated testing, things that stand the test of time become increasingly immune to those sorts of effects. And I think there can be real confusion in discussing these issues, because the sociology matters, but it isn't all just sociology, if you see the point I'm making. So short-term success and endeavour may well be introduced by, whether you went to Oxford or Cambridge, or whether you knew the right people, or whether what you were working on was particularly sexy that year. It does. I've seen it. But for something to have a long-standing and persisting advance in knowledge requires this constant testing and the survival of an idea or a way of thinking. And so that's what makes science more reliable. So it's a weird combination. It is influenced sociologically, but in the longer term, I think it's self-correcting. Not everybody would agree with me, but that is certainly my view of it.
All right, thanks. Question from the floor? All right. The individual in the front, please.
Popper was horrified by specialization. He commented in connection with Kuhn's Normal Science that it was a threat to science and indeed to civilization. He believed in cosmology. And I would like to make a suggestion and ask for your comment about what to do about the situation. It seems to me that we need to do two things. First of all, reform philosophy so that it has as its basic task to concern itself with fundamental problems, problems that cut across all disciplinary boundaries, and also that it's not just done by philosophers, and then put philosophy and science together again and recreate natural philosophy, a modern version of natural philosophy. And then we would have a counteraction to all the specialization?
Well, as you've heard, I also think we've over-specialized. I also think you've heard from what I said that philosophy has much to contribute to us. I don't agree with Richard Feynman. I think we have things to learn from each other. And I've just set up one of the people heavily involved in setting up a new institute where we have a graduate school. And it worries me that graduate school is embedded in a specialized biomedical research institute. I know we are focused and have the highest standard and do the highest quality of work, but we need to have within that a program of activities that broaden what we do. And I've invented a series, I'm calling it Insight Lectures, which are aimed at doing exactly that. And that is to expose them to thinkers and disciplines that they're not normally exposed to, not only strictly biological and biomedical, but philosophical and political, for that matter, and sociological as well. So I'm completely on board with you.
Right. A question from the woman in the front row.
Hi there. I'm a PhD student at UCL doing immunology. And my question is, like, having experience a bit of the scientific community, is regarding this issue of reproducibility. And I can accept that there are people who are fraudulent, and I can accept that there's variation in experimental method. But really, it seems that the community truths in science seem to play a much greater role than, in fact, nature in driving hypotheses. And in a way, although you say you were depressed as a graduate student in the 70s, I kind of romanticize those days of when you could finish a science paper saying, like, we're not quite sure how it works. We're going to leave it to the experts to kind of explore this in more detail, and in a way, whether you see that there's a way to return back to this. And just, you know, because science papers at the moment, I think the statistic is like 90% of them are irreproducible, which means that, you know, I don't think it can all be explained by fraud or experimental variation.
It hugely exaggerated, that figure, if I may say. I mean, you're an immunologist, and, you know, I mean, actually, I suspect the papers that are claiming such a high rate of lack of reproducibility will not be reproducible. What they have done is taken very particular protocols, they've done something, and they didn't get the answer, they publish it as a negative. I know that we can spend months perfecting something to get it to work. And if we gave up after a week, which they must have done, it's meaningless. I think this is an utter storm in a teacup. I'm not saying there's not an issue, and I take fraud and all these things seriously, really seriously, and I've taken medals from people because they've been shown to be fraudulent, for example, but it is hugely exaggerated. Don't despair about that. It is on firm foundations, but there are, some rotten apples, which we have to dispose of, and there are just some things that are very difficult and therefore not reproducible. I mean, you didn't ask this, you know, I've worked for 40 years. I could destroy my entire reputation with one bad experiment or one bad person working my lab. I mean, the risk is huge. I mean, I don't want to do that. So we take huge care to actually get it right. And I think many people think like that. Because you always get found out. I mean, you get found out every damn time, unless it's irrelevant.
All right, the person in the back
now
center.
I'm getting more questions. Yes. Where are you?
So just wait for the microphone, please.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Got you.
Affiliated with LSC. In your talk, you've drawn very much on your experience of research in the life sciences.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether you've feel that there are significant differences between different sciences, physics, chemistry, life sciences, economics, in the way in which they approach some of these problems alongside the common aspects of the scientific endeavor.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I spoke about the life sciences because that's what I know about. I dare not speak about the economic sciences in LSE, of course. but others will. My daughter is a physicist who works at Geneva at CERN and at UCL, actually. So I talk a lot with her. I think physics is a bit different. Certainly in her area, there is the way experiments are done, many, many collaborators working on different aspects of it, many, many tests being carried out on the data as it is emerging, and the way in which they evaluate that data before the paper gets published is really quite different from the way that the life sciences are generally pursued, which is done by smaller groups, sometimes getting increasingly larger, who are more self-referential. And the test comes out after the publication rather than before publication. Also, on the whole, physics deals with a sort of firmer foundation. It doesn't deal with lots of different particulars. Us biologists like lots of particulars. You know, we count how many hairs there are on beetles' legs and things of that sort, or at least we did in the 19th century. And whereas physicists tend to work in a different sort of arena. So I do think it matters. I also think, and you may, I said one sentence about it, that often the philosophers of science have focused more on physics than they have on the life sciences. And I think it's the life sciences that are generally more in need of philosophical thinking, though it's got to also overspill into psychology and sociology, in my view. And I think it would be, I find that often the life science philosophers tend to discuss the great ideas of biology, which is always sort of a good thing. I'm interested in that. But they don't discuss so much on the methodology and the way you do science in the same way as, you know, Kuhn and Popper were thinking about, I think, mainly in physics. So I think we need more attention in that area. It would be my amateurish comment.
Right, another question. Let's have one from the left-hand side of the upper deck. So the person in the second row.
My name's Akram Khan. I'm from Brunel University. I just want to pick you up on the particle physics aspect.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a theory which is approximately 40 years old now, and we're verifying the theory itself with experiments which are very, very expensive, and we're doing these huge, big, you know, multi-billion-dollar experiments. And what they're doing is they're just verifying the theory that has existed before and does exist now. And when you want to falsify the theory, we require experiments that are never going to be built within our or, you know, future generations. So the accelerators that one needs are far beyond what we can ever build at the present moment. So is that a science in the Popperian sense? Yeah. Or should I get more depressed?
Yeah, I've talked a bit about this with my daughter because she did say some things that that sort of resonate a bit with that, in that obviously the arguments for building the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, were made by a large part of the community of scientists trying to determine the next bit in the standard model, and that everything was designed, and even the reporting of the experimental data, this is beyond my pay scale, by the way, the reporting of the experimental data was made in such a way that it is consistent with the view. And she actually was bothered about this and was and has got a grant to actually, which to do a small step to maybe try and deal with this, which is at least to make the data more value-free, if I can put it that way. You're looking at me as if I've just crawled out of underneath a stone. But I mean, what I meant was that that those who may not have that particular view of the world might be able to at least access that data in a way to test it in a particular in their situation. That's what she tells me. It's all incomprehensible to me, so I can't comment on it beyond that. But it does resonate in part with what you've said.
But does it not worry you to some extent? Because now you're using a very complicated term, value-free data.
Yep.
And that's not what we do. I mean, that's not the the done thing in particle physics, is it?
Well, what I'm saying is...
data has no value.
That, well, you heard when you said, does it bother me? I mean, I think we have to recognize, I say again, that we are human beings and we're subject to the to issues exactly like that. I don't think that means we should just throw our hands up in despair, but I think we do have to recognize it. So I am sure the physics community runs on rails just like our community does. And, of course, these damn machines are so big and expensive, it's difficult to jump onto another rail. I understand what you say. But I think it will happen. I think it will happen from somewhere else, like observing something out, you know, on a, in space somewhere, which will tell it in a different way. But as I told you, I'm an idealist about these sorts of things. I wasn't trying to idealise physics, but I do think it's not subject to the same sort of issues that we have in the life sciences to the same extent. But I'm sure what you said is right, that there is a certain, I won't call it conservatism, but there's certainly a way of thinking which predominates at a certain point in time.
But don't you think we also have reached
Thank you very much for your question. Let's just try to get a few other people to...
I see I haven't agreed enough with you. I thought I was doing quite a good job of it, actually.
Well, having taught philosophy, I know that if you are searching for agreement, you'll almost never reach the point of a conversation. So can we have a question from the person over on the right by the aisle? I'll come back downstairs in the next.
Thank you. Next can you hour. Hear me? Yeah. My name is Lindsay. I'm a reporter for Research Fortnight. When I told my editor I was coming to this talk earlier, he was really excited, and he told me loads about all kinds of philosophers I'd never heard of when I studied science. I wondered, has philosophy of science seen its heyday, and do you think it's due a resurgence?
No, it hasn't. We need it. We need it. I mean, I did a philosophy and science course as an undergraduate, taught by an amateur philosopher, you know, in the department, who had an amateur interest, professor of zoology, Lowenstein, which was interesting, but didn't get to the problem. I mean, I actually really think this is quite a sophisticated subject. The more you go into it, knowing what is truth and understanding and knowing what progress is, this is all difficult and unsettling, and I think we should embrace it. So I don't think it's lost. I think it comes and goes. I think that sometimes it gets a bit divorced from reality, you know, and to some extent Feynman can get it right. I mean, it can get a bit irrelevant. But actually, this is really, science is closely connected with epistemology, you know, with knowledge and the generation of knowledge. And I do think we have to engage with those discussions. You should try in research fortnightly.
All right, another question. So could we get a question from the individual over there on the right, please?
I think, is it on? Yes, yeah. Yeah, no, it's got the light on, but maybe get it closer to your mouth. Yeah.
Political past, no affiliation. Thank you very much for your talk. I would just like to, query the sort of psychological aspect of the human mind always looking for the comfort of...
Ah, that's better.
Okay. query whether, you know, how the philosophy and the psychology comes together, where the human mind's looking for confirmation and likes the comfort of being right, and therefore the value of actually proving the negative hypothesis, where you're actually starting out to say, I think this is wrong, and I want to prove that it is wrong, because then that will then allow your confirmation bias to actually come into play and say, great, I was right that I was wrong. So... can you comment on how much you use the sort of negative hypothesis? I know it doesn't make such great reading for scientific papers and your publication record, but what's the value of it?
I'm not a psychologist, of course, and I don't want to sort of emphasize that these are sort of like negative results, because then they're, of course, not. What I think was useful for me in thinking in this way that Popper was explaining is that you have an idea, and it may be you will love it, of course, you know, because everybody always loves their own ideas. And you try and address it from all sorts of directions. It's some way I sort of like think about it. I think when you have a sort of verifying approach, to go back to where we were before, often that is focused on only one sort of direction into testing it. And you will do it and it looks as if you're doing many different experiments that help, when they're all of the same category. And what helps, particularly in the life sciences, is to address a problem using really very different sort of disciplinary approaches and technical approaches. And that can be, you know, I'm a geneticist, but I use genetics and cell biology and biochemistry, all of which have weaknesses and strengths. And if it stands up against all of that, I feel more secure. Now, I'm not quite sure how this sort of plays into the psychology of it, but it's just... one bit that is important in the psychology is, if my idea is wrong, I want to show it's wrong. I mean, that's psychological, isn't it? I don't want him to show it's wrong, you know, because then that humiliates me. So, I mean, if it's wrong, I want to show it's wrong, and therefore I'm going to test it to destruction, so when it gets out there, it's not going to be easy to pull apart. And that actually helped, you know, that's a sort of way of sort of thinking about it. But it is approaching it in different sorts of ways. I think it's important.
All right. Can we get a question from the gentleman in the second row over on the left, on the upper deck, please?
Hello. Peter Sozu, LSE. On the last point, it's interesting that people should be able to test their own theories to destruction. What I've observed seems to sometimes happen is that you often get research groups that are run by a dominant personality, and all the papers out of that, whether it's a controversial issue, all the papers out of a particular research group often all tend to support the same point of view. That research group, if you like, has a corporate point of view. Then there'll be another research group that supports a different...
with another corporate view. Yeah.
Exactly. That's my impression. Is that your impression too? And if so, do you think that's a problem?
Yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem. I think there is a bit of it was nicely put, you know, a corporate position from a laboratory. And you get suspicious of it when you see that all the time, because you know that it's unlikely that everything has got completely right and that is the only view of it. And you are right that I call them the barons of science, who sort of build a fortification around themselves. But, of course, the higher the wall goes, the higher it falls when it does eventually fall. But we do see that, and they tend to run big machines. I mean, I don't mean Large Hadron Colliders. I mean big operations, and there does tend to be a conservatism in it. My own lab, and for that matter the Francis Crick Institute, operates in a... often I call it a sort of culture of gentle anarchy, you know. I think that it's a much more creative and profitable culture where you're constantly challenging each other in a don't want to quite say positive way, but a sympathetic sort of way. In other words, you don't say you're an idiot. You just say that was an idiotic idea or comment, which is... somewhat different. But yeah, I think it's a problem, the corporate thing, and in the end they dry up, actually. I mean, I keep talking about the long term and it gets it right, and of course you could say, well, it might take 20 years and they've sucked up all this resource and so on to do it, and that is true. But in the end it sort of dries up and is no longer profitable, and it sort of, they fritter away. I hope, anyway.
All right, we've got time for a few more questions. So could I get a question from the individual on the back on the upper deck?
Thanks. John Fox, Oxford University. Paul, a lot of people claim that artificial intelligence is going to revolutionise science and medicine and quite a few other things.
Yep.
And precision oncology is a phrase to conjure with.
Yeah, something else I don't like. That sounds pretty corporate too, doesn't it?
But I don't think many computers are Popperian or Lakatoshian or Kuhnian or Baconian. They might be Bayesian, but there's a lot of kind of things that they don't do. They're just kind of remorseless in going through data. Do you think that's a good or bad development in science?
I think understanding the world's difficult. I'll do anything that helps us, you know? And I think at a trivial level, which is not the level you're really referring to, but let's take the Large Hadron Collider again. I mean, you have to sort through the data to find out things that you can interpret, which are meaningful in the hypothesis. I mean, this is the problem that you're referring to, because you only examine 1% of the data because it confirms them, you know, it's the hypothesis you're trying to test. But looking for regularities and looking for regularities that can inform you about underlying understanding, I think is really very straightforward and very necessary. You're probably thinking about, where are we going to end up with AO and Go and all this sort of stuff. And I don't really quite know. I'm sort of interested in it, so I am talking to DeepMind a bit about what we might do together biologically. The guy who leads DeepMind happens to be married to one of my ex-graduate students, so we're quite sort of connected. But I don't quite know where I come out on ultimately where AI may take us. I think it's overdone at the moment, but it may not be overdone in the future. Now, you're in this area. What do you think? Give him the mic back.
Yeah. Well, as you know, I spent a lot of time working for you and your predecessor trying to apply AI in clinical medicine. And I think we had some successes and even involved in a bit of science. But people were always kind of still deciding what the experiments were and what was interesting and so on. And then you then use computers to do some of the kind of routine stuff. I think I'm as perplexed as you. I'm probably more opinionated than you about various aspects of AI, but I'm as least as uncertain as you about whether big data and machine learning and all of these things are really going to revolutionise things, or whether they're just going to turn out to be another useful tool that people manage and people control, and you're still dependent on what you call scientific intuition, to really ask the good questions.
Yep.
All right, then.
I'm on the fence. Yep.
Right. We have time for one last quick question. So I think just in fairness, I'll take one from the lower deck. So can we have the individual in front here who's been patiently waiting? All right.
Thank you. Hi, Jamie Rumbelow from the New College of the Humanities. Wonderful lecture, thank you very much. Sort of following on from the previous comment about scientific intuition, you told a really nice story about how not following the Popperian falsifiability criteria led you to discover something because you just weren't looking at that. As in your career as a practicing scientist, particularly in the context of discovery, trying to figure out what conjectures you ought to be making, are there any particular heuristics that you found surprisingly fruitful or particularly useful? Or to put it another way, what can you point to that has helped you hone and improve your scientific intuition?
Yeah, now, I can say some things. It is a bit limited by the life sciences because it's what I'm exposed to. This phrase I use, following where nature may lead, is really, really useful because it sounds corny, but it means you're basically keeping an eye on what reality is there, and it's helping you guide what you should think about and how you should think about it. And I think that's really important because it helps you escape from the prison of your own mind. I mean, Popper was arguing, that everything is, of course, human-constructed, and that is true. But once you've constructed something, it's quite difficult to jump from something else, and I think that's one way of doing it. The second way, which is to do with the specialization thing, I think it is really, really valuable to recognize that we do run on rails, that so often what's happened to me or people who have worked with me, that you have an idea to explain something you're studying, And whilst you have it, you can't think of any other idea that will explain it. It's psychologically peculiar. You just keep going on going and going. And you think there is no other way to explain it until there is another way to explain it, and when you don't realise why you never thought of it. And there's something to do with the way we work, that we can't jump that. And reading other stuff, having a broader perspective, will help you come at things in different sorts of ways. Taking a holiday helps. So that's what I tell my... Just getting away from it all and then coming back with a fresh way of doing it. Third thing is proper discussion and debate. There is perhaps too much emphasis on you read the paper, you put in the keyword, you assimilate what is the received wisdom. Having free-ranging debate amongst equals who respect each other, so you can say whatever you like and they don't feel humiliated by it. And by the way, this is much easier to say than to do, I'm afraid. Keeping testosterone out of it, for example, is really, really helpful in sort of probing away. And I do find that that is something that we really need to preserve and to keep. So that's something else. Really free, engaged activity. So with my lab, I take us all away for a week on a retreat. It's rather religious, really. I mean, we go to a house or somewhere in the middle of absolutely nowhere in February when the weather's awful and there's nothing else you can do. And we sit in there for 5 days. And we look at everything that we do from every possible angle, and it is all aimed at just trying to unearth different ways of thinking at things. 90% failure, and then we just go to the pub, and 10% something pops up. So I think I'm saying there are tricks you can use, and we have to use them to get out of the rut of our thinking.
All right, so... To all members of the audience, it's been a great pleasure for me, and I thank all of you to have had the opportunity to listen to Sir Paul Nurse tonight. Thank you very much for your visit. A reception will be held on the 6th floor of the old building in the Shaw Library. Very much like to invite you to attend. Please note that access via lifts is a bit slow and limited, so if you are able to climb the 6 flights of stairs, please do so. Think of it as not needing to go to the gym tomorrow. And please join me one last time in thanking Paul for his talk tonight.